Welcome to Nerds at Church, a podcast about nerdery and the Bible. I'm Pastor Emily, and I use pronouns like they, them, theirs.
And I'm Pastor Kay, and my pronouns are she, her. In this episode, we'll discuss the 12th Sunday after Pentecost, also known as Lectionary 20 or Proper 15, which this year falls on August 20th. We have one content note for you for this episode. We discuss racism mostly during the deep dive, but also somewhat throughout the episode.
Check out the episode description for links to the Bible passages and other references we make in this episode.
So our gospel reading for today is going to be Jesus speaking to the Canaanite woman. And because of the various things going on in that conversation and the background of it, we decided to do our deep dive for today on equity and the concepts of equity versus justice, and specifically how that has played out in the United States regarding affirmative action, regarding race and the Supreme Court and legacy college enrollment and so forth. Now, as we talk about these things, we want to point out that equality and equity and justice are all ideals. And affirmative action is policy, which is attempting to encourage some of those ideals. So when we talk about affirmative action, we're going to be more concrete and gritty, I guess, than when talking about the ideals of equality, equity, and justice.
So first, to like kind of set the stage a little bit, we're going to talk about the main big words that we're using and kind of what they mean and how affirmative action fits within those. So the first one that even is perhaps a precursor to equity, equality, or justice is diversity, which is when there are people present with different identities from each other at its basic. Sure. When we're talking about people, diverse people, ecosystem, whole other species, literally. Sure. And so one of the things about diversity is part of diversity is getting at the representation. And that representation matters. It matters when we can see ourselves in people on TV. It matters when people who are different are showing up together. The other piece of it, though, is that tokenizing fits here. Having one person from each different category or that sort of a thing, which is not conducive to systemic change at all. And can actually be really isolating and harmful to the person who is being tokenized, the one person of color, queer person, etc.
Yeah.
And then a lot of the time we talk about equality. That's kind of like the next step of what we talk about after we talk about, okay, we want diverse people. We also want equality. And equality is about, frequently is the way we talk about it in try to live it out, is about treating everyone the same regardless of their differences. So this is a concept that sounds good on the surface level, but actually can be really harmful because if you are looking at, for example, in the animal world, if you are looking at a sloth expecting it to run fast because it's a race, the sloth will always lose and the cheetah will always win.
Sure.
So treating everyone the same, regardless of difference, doesn't take into account the gift of difference. It tends to minimize difference. And the goals of affirmative action can usually go here, right? The goals of affirmative action are to get people into the school or into the job opportunity, regardless of their difference, regardless of their race or gender or sexual orientation. And at least that's a lot of how affirmative action has played out, particularly when it comes to affirmative action as designed by the people who don't need it.
Yeah.
So we're not saying that affirmative action is about equality and that's it, but the goals of affirmative action are in some ways to get us to a place where we can have equality, but
how that plays out practically is a completely different set of questions.
We're living in the real world here for this one. And then justice. And justice is creating opportunities for those who have historically been denied them. And justice is repairing harm that has been done. So affirmative action usually fits here because it is about creating opportunities for those who have historically been denied them. And reparations generally fits here because it's about repairing the harm right? When we talk about reparations, the 40 acres and a mule is one of the things that comes up because that's what was promised at the end of the Civil War and never delivered on. And so reparations is attempting to mitigate the harm that was done, to repair the harm that was done and the injustice that was created. But in and of itself, it is not enough. Like, there is more that is needed than just reparations or even than just affirmative action. And that's kind of where we get to equity. And as Kay mentioned, all of these are ideals. Equity is a little bit more of a space of rubber hits the road in that it is an ideal and takes into account a little bit more actual reality. So equity creates situations that take into account differences and disabilities, and especially historic disadvantages, in order to give everyone the best shot at succeeding. So it's not expecting everyone to be the same, to act the same, to have the same experience, to do the same thing, but actually taking into account difference and creating the space for difference to be a result. And so this gets at challenging implicit bias and recognizing implicit bias and structural barriers to participation, to engagement, to leadership, to advancement, to all of those things. And it's an actual valuing of difference and diversity for the sake of everyone, recognizing that everything is better when there is more diversity present and when people can bring their whole selves to a job, a school, a situation. And this is affirmative action in a lot of ways is trying to do equity. It's trying to take into account people's lived experiences and historical experiences and create a situation where they can thrive.
Yeah.
So that's like a very, very, very brief way of thinking about those. And it's limited. Like, both Kay and I are white Christian pastors. So we have some limits in our understanding, but I've also done some work around this. So if you have different definitions or different ways of understanding those words, we would love to hear from you. Let us know and we'll share with folks in future episodes, because there's a lot of different perspectives on this that are important to talk to, and especially for the perspectives of folks who are Black, Indigenous people of color, because they have historically been most significantly harmed and have done the most intentional and in-depth work around this.
Yeah.
So when we're talking about affirmative action, a lot of people don't actually know the history, and I didn't know a lot of the history until mostly Kay did the background research for this episode. But the early affirmative action history, the first time the term affirmative action appeared was in the National Labor Relations Act. So it was connected to labor. That act is also known as the Wagner Act, in 1935. So it was Senator Robert F. Wagner of New York was the one who was like really championing it, along with President Roosevelt's goal to provide economic security to workers and other income groups. And at this time, it was fairly common for employers to blacklist or fire employees who were associated with unions. It's one of the tactics in union busting, which Starbucks has actually been doing, even though it's now illegal. So,
And, you know, a bunch of other companies.
Yes, a bunch of other.
Starbucks is the one making headlines.
And the Wagner Act allowed workers to unionize without fear of being discriminated against and empowered the National Labor Relations Board to review cases of worker discrimination, and in the event of discrimination, to restore employees to appropriate status in the company through, quote unquote, affirmative action. So that's a very different understanding of affirmative action than what we mean when we talk about it today. For the most part, we were usually talking about it in regards to education and specifically college applications and acceptance, but is a really important point, right? When we think about the histories and the roots of this term, it was about creating the space for people to more justly access work and organizing. Which, if you want to know more about labor organizing, you can check out our episode that we did two summers ago, I believe, with Ale about labor organizing, and we'll link to it in the episode description.
Yeah. The next big step in the United States was that in 1946, President Truman heard the story of Sergeant Isaac Woodard, who was a black man who had just been honorably discharged from the Army in World War II, and he was on a bus home and passing through a town that he wasn't familiar with. He was pulled off the bus by police, beaten and blinded, and left with some amnesia, and convicted of disorderly conduct and fined, and then put in a hospital with substandard care for 3 weeks, all of which happened while his family had no idea where he was or what had happened to him. And then he was eventually found and sent to an army hospital and received proper treatment, but he was blind for the rest of his life.
Mm-hmm.
In response to hearing this story and others, but this one was apparently the one that really got a reaction out of President Truman, the president founded the President's Committee on Civil Rights, which released their findings a year later or so in a book called To Secure These Rights in 1947. And this book examined and outlined Jim Crow policies in the South, and also how Japanese Americans had been treated in California and in the internment camps during the war, and various other race-related issues in the United States of the day. And basically, this report suggested a variety of measures around the country to improve what they called race relations, such as developing a federal protection against lynching and abolishing poll taxes, and then the formation of various government groups and committees related to civil rights, and also, for example, a permanent fair employment practice commission, that kind of thing, in order to encourage better treatment according to the law for all of our citizens.
Mm-hmm. And then skipping ahead, in 1961, JFK signed an executive order that used the term affirmative action, which included a provision that government contractors specifically, and I think it's interesting to note here that the president has a fair amount of authority when it comes to federal or government employees and contractors and that sort of a thing. And so a lot of times we'll see stuff like this, where the minimum wage will be raised for government contractor, for anyone doing business with the government. Or in this case, government contractors should take affirmative action to ensure that applicants are employed and employees are treated fairly during employment without regard to their race, creed, color, or national origin. And so this executive order was used to promote actions that achieve non-discrimination. And what I think is also interesting about this is the way affirmative action is framed in this case is to prevent discrimination. And the language around affirmative action has changed a lot, and I think not for the best, because at its heart, affirmative action is countering the implicit bias and the discrimination that would happen without it.
And there are plenty of studies and records that show that that bias exists and still
exists. Yes, there's like a whole Harvard implicit bias test if you would like to check your own implicit bias in a variety of kind of categories.
Sure, but also like there are actual records and studies of like how does employment work? How do admission to various programs work? Like all of those studies also say that yes, all of these biases still exist.
Yes, true. And then in 1965, LBJ issued another executive order which required government employers to hire without regard to race, religion, and national origin and take affirmative action to ensure that applicants are employed and that employees are treated during employment without regard to race, color, religion, sex, or national origin. So in this one, creed is changed to religion and then they add in sex. And I think that's important because it starts to get at, okay, we're recognizing the intersectionality of things, not using that term per se, but recognizing that there are multiple ways that people can be discriminated against that need to be taken into account. And then the Civil Rights Act of 1964 prohibited discrimination on the basis of race, color, religion, sex, or national origin. And the executive orders and the Civil Rights Act, both of those were prohibiting discrimination, like I said, not authorizing preference. So it's not saying preference these groups, but saying don't discriminate against these groups. Don't automatically dock points from these groups.
Yeah. Okay, so let's talk about affirmative action and college admissions before the recent Supreme Court decision. And my background personally for speaking about this is that my mom, for her entire career, was an academic advisor at a state university. So I have some awareness of how academia works. You know how you hear about pastors' kids who never step foot in a church again after they turn 18? I am kind of that, but academia. I got exactly the degree I needed to do my job, and then I got the heck out, because I knew a little bit too much about how academia worked and how the sausage is made. So before the phrase affirmative action was a thing, back in, you know, the 40s and before that and so forth, before that became a known phrase, many colleges and universities admitted certain numbers or percentages of various minority groups, including women and also various racial minorities, who were often divided into groups that didn't always make any objective sense, and also like Jewish students and so forth. So they would admit a certain number of those various groups according to their own choosing, often very small numbers or percentages of their classes. For example, in Mona Lisa Smile, Julia Roberts' character mentions that Yale Law used to hold 5 spots open for women in each admitted class, and one of those spots was traditionally held for a graduate of Wellesley College. That meant that the vast majority of schools, not just Ivy League, but especially Ivy League, admitted mostly white men, and any other students who were admitted had to have an extraordinary level of accomplishment to even get considered in the first place.
I recently read the graphic novel Becoming RBG about Ruth Bader Ginsburg and her journey, sure. And it talks some about her process of law school and getting into law school and all of that, too. Right along with this of like having to be and do better than everybody and all of that stuff. So yeah, just as another like resource and example.
Sure, absolutely. So while many of the Ivy League schools refused to admit Jewish students on equal footing with Christian students, that is to say, based on merit rather than religion, for generations before affirmative action became policy anywhere, MIT, Massachusetts Institute of Technology, did welcome Jewish students on an equal basis. They were just considered on an equal basis with Christian students based on merit rather than religion. And this comes up semi-frequently in MCU fanfiction because there's often an assumption that Tony Stark has some Jewish heritage, and Howard Stark, in I believe almost all of the comics, went to MIT. And so that comes up now and then. And when we talk about all this, let's also note that all of this conversation about affirmative action in colleges is always entirely about the admission process alone. Students still faced and still do face discrimination on campus as students, and this makes it more difficult for them to graduate than their peers when they're going through that discrimination, and it used to be even more blatant than it is now.
Although there's been a resurgence in its blatancy with the last few years.
Absolutely. Yeah, so it's getting worse again. And also, admission has never just been about test scores and GPA numbers, because it really can't be. You also include things like interviews and essays and letters of recommendation and extracurricular activities and so forth. When my mom considered students to admit, and she was not like the final decision on anybody, as far as I know. Those decisions were always made with a group of people. She said that one quality that she looked for in students was who focused on what they had accomplished and what they wanted to accomplish. Students with specific and concrete goals and plans, because that spoke to a student who knew what they were going for and had a plan. And you're more likely to graduate if you have a plan and you know where you're going, at least with some sense of direction. Also, most colleges and universities have always had an easier admission policy for the children of previous graduates. This is often called legacy admission, and they treat those students a little more gently than other students in terms of the admission process in various ways, which has meant that earlier racist policies, even though they're no longer actively in effect, they continue to echo through current admission policies because the legacy students tend to be white and from upper class backgrounds because their parents could go to college.
And we'll get into this a little bit more later also, because that is called affirmative action in the way that we understand it today.
Yeah, sort of. The whole point of affirmative action is to be working against that kind of thing. But
it is a different type of affirmative action.
I would say it's discrimination, but yeah. And so then in the late 60s and early 70s, there was this sort of ongoing realization and process that happened in many schools and universities. They started noticing that major tests like the SAT and the ACT, and also like graduate level tests like the MCAT or the LSAT, these often did not accurately represent the abilities of students who were not white. And so many schools started to weight those test scores as they considered future students. For minority students, they would weight those scores less than, say, their grades or their essays, because they wanted students who would perform better in their classes overall, and they realized that these test scores were not actually going to mean as much for these particular students as they would for other students.
Which is interesting, because in, like, different respects, there are a lot of those, like, standardized tests that actually were created specifically to make it harder for people to achieve things. So if you think about the bar exam was not always required for lawyers. It was required to keep particularly people of color, especially men of color at the time, from becoming lawyers.
Yeah.
So, like, that was their purpose.
Yeah. And some of the people making these decisions realized that or knew that already. Mm-hmm. And having looked into this some and having heard about it from people who, you know, worked in these kind of jobs, as far as I can tell, there have never been any laws requiring schools to admit more minority students than they would otherwise, aside from very broad general requirements like the Civil Rights Act and the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment in the Constitution. Basically, as long as the schools don't violate those, they're fine. So there are two major Supreme Court cases that people tend to talk about when they talk about affirmative action and college admission. The first is the Regents of the University of California versus Bakke. And what happened with this one is that the medical school of UC Davis admitted 100 students each year. In the early 70s, they had a policy of holding 16 of those slots, 16 out of 100, for minority students. And for those minority students, they did not hold those students to all of the usual admission policies, the usual baseline rules of what you had to meet in order to be considered for admission, mm-hmm. which would acknowledge the possibility of, say, racism on the part of their teachers or the tests that they had taken, mm-hmm. that kind of thing. But they still chose those students based on who were believed to become the best students. Like, all colleges want the best possible students because that increases their reputation. Mm-hmm. And so in 1974, Alan Bakke's case against the UC Davis came to the Supreme Court. He was white and had been rejected from the program twice, and claimed that he would have gotten in if this program for minority students didn't exist because of his MCAT score and his GPA. But do remember, of course, that more than that are considered in the admissions mm-hmm. process, like the interviews and essays and letters of recommendation and so forth.
Sorry.
Possibly, yeah. Yeah, I mean, you know, making a good impression on the staff in general is always a good policy. I don't know anything particular about this guy aside from this court case. And he won the case, as the court said that the policy of UC Davis did violate the Equal Protection Clause. He was admitted, and the decision made it illegal for schools to admit minority students with lesser requirements than they had for white students. But it still allowed schools to generally consider race in their admissions choices. And then the second Supreme Court case that people talk about is Hopwood versus Texas. And this one was repealed in 2003. I'll get to that in a second. Cheryl Hopwood filed a lawsuit against the University of Texas School of Law, and her case reached the Supreme Court in 1996, as she and a handful of other white students hadn't been admitted despite having better LSAT grades and GPAs. See how these are, again, quantifiable things, mm-hmm. than some of the minority students who had been admitted. And again, this did not take into account things like interviews, essays, letters of rec, extracurricular stuff, things like that. And the Supreme Court refused to hear the case and upheld the Fifth Circuit Court's decision to outlaw any use of race factoring into school admissions. Many universities and other schools were disappointed by this decision since, as previously mentioned, they knew that certain metrics like test scores were less able to predict the performance of their minority students. The ruling was later repealed in 2003 with Grutter versus Bollinger. I'm not entirely sure I'm pronouncing those right. Which decided that the Constitution, quote, does not prohibit the law school's narrowly tailored use of race in admissions decisions to further a compelling interest in obtaining the educational benefits that flow from a diverse student body. Because there are educational benefits to having a diverse student mm-hmm. body, which I feel like I shouldn't have to say out loud, but here we are.
Yeah. And what I think is interesting is that the assumption that are made by people who are saying, no, you're discriminating, that affirmative action is like reverse racism, right? Those sorts of, I'm using air quotes on reverse racism because that is not a thing, but those sorts of arguments are based in this incorrect belief that the test scores, that there isn't already bias built into every step of the way. Like, there are so many studies that show how racist teachers can negatively impact students of color and the classroom in general, right? There's just so much that shows the bias of these test scores that were created in order to keep people out.
Yeah.
That it's baffling to me when people talk about affirmative action with this stuff that I'm like, I don't think you understand everything.
Yeah. I mean, most people don't, but yeah.
Also true. So then we get to the recent Supreme Court decision at the end of June of this year, 2023, which was based off of two cases, Students for Fair Admission versus Harvard and Students for Fair Admission versus University of North Carolina, which struck down affirmative action based on race, but not on the alumni status of parents or money or those sorts of things. So the decision makes it so that race cannot be used to decide admissions at the college level. And something that I think is really important to know, because when this first came out, there was a lot of pushback against Asian American students. They didn't bring this. Students for Fair Admission is not an organization created by students. Students for Fair Admission is an organization founded in 2014 by the super conservative activist Edward Bloom in order to challenge affirmative action admissions policies at schools. Like, the purpose of this was to go after affirmative action. And the way that we talk about affirmative action today versus the origins of the term, again, being not to discriminate based on race, to prevent discrimination that is already happening and built into the system, particularly based on race. The way we talk about affirmative action today is as an uplifting. And the reality is affirmative action has still, because we haven't addressed all of the systemic stuff, has still been about countering the discrimination that is already faced, particularly by Black, Indigenous people of color, but also by queer people, by women, other people with marginalized identities. But the way it's talked about is that it preferences people of color, that it preferences women over and above white people, particularly white men, in terms of applications and acceptance and admission. And that is problematic on a number of levels. Partly, there is a sense of entitlement, right? It points towards the entitlement that particularly white students and white families feel, that they are entitled to those positions, and that when people who are benefiting from affirmative action receive admission and they don't, that their position that they're entitled to was taken from them, when in reality, they're not entitled to anything. And if we're talking about affirmative action in that sense of like preferencing, the actual affirmative action that happens all the time and that wasn't challenged and wasn't struck down by this decision is, as I mentioned before, and Kay pushed back because we were using different definitions, right? But when we think about legacy admissions, when we think about people who give significant amounts of money to colleges because they can so that their kids can get in, that is affirmative action in the sense that people are claiming actual affirmative action is, right? It is preferencing particular groups of people based on.
Yeah, whereas I would say it's not affirmative action because the whole point of affirmative action is supposed to get rid of racism. And this is, you know, enacting racism.
Yeah, so it's not actually the thing, but the way that the Students for Fair Admissions court cases were framed and decided was specific about affirmative action with regards to race. And so that's the space where, like, it doesn't say you can't take into account parental alumni status, you can't take into account these things that have nothing to do with the student's actual ability to be a good college student and a good member of the student body, right? And so it's just saying race is the one thing that we have decided is not, which actually can have a positive impact on student body, right? But like the amount of money your parents give to the college or the fact that your parents went there doesn't actually make you a better student. And so when we're talking about affirmative action, like that's the thing, is like the way the court case was decided was specifically about race, when that is not the only factor that is used, and when there are other factors like alumni status and economic status that actually have zero bearing on ability to be a good student, that are used to benefit particularly white students in getting into the college.
Yeah.
I clearly have strong opinions about this, but I do think it's important to recognize those kind of nuances and the ways that the language we have used around affirmative action has shifted. And that's largely because people like Edward Bloom there has been a long process of shifting the narrative, including, like, I remember in our debate group debating affirmative action and the idea that people of color, particularly Black people, can't actually be objective about affirmative action and white people can, right? There's this sense of white people as the default and as objectivity, which goes with the test scores, which goes with all of that and is harmful and a lie. Okay. After that rant, and lots of very important information, affirmative action is not just used in college admissions. As we mentioned, its origins are around employment practices. And there are a lot of companies who have realized that it is better to have more diverse people in the company. Now, many of us have seen the like pyramids of hierarchies where like the little avatars at the very bottom of a company are really diverse, and the higher up you go, the less diversity there is. And then there's usually just a white man as the CEO, and there might be one white woman on the board or something. So that's a great example of diversity, but not equity, but not the steps needed to actually have equity and equality and justice. So companies have then done, okay, well, we want to take affirmative action in our hiring practices, which again is to counter the implicit bias and the built-in barriers that particularly Black, Indigenous, people of color face, and also gender minorities face, sexual minorities, people with disabilities, all of those, right? And so the like most basic version of affirmative action is we want to make sure we have at least one candidate or at least X number of candidates in the final slate of candidates for this position who is a person of color, that sort of a thing. And the problem with that is that if you have one person of color and the rest are white, then that person is almost guaranteed not to get the job. Their chances of getting the job are less than the rest of the group. If you have more than one person, their chances increase because there's less of a like tokenizing factor, because there's
at least we considered one.
Yeah. Right. Like, and there's so often that, and I know that like I, as a queer person in the church, have experienced this, right? Where you get to be the final slate, right? One of the final candidates. And the default almost always goes to picking the cishet white person, right?
When it comes to women, this is often called the glass ceiling.
Yep.
And when it comes to women getting fired, it's also called the glass cliff, because women are hired for jobs that are the most difficult. And then when they fail, because obviously anyone put in that job was going to fail, they get fired. And that is the glass cliff.
And in the church, we call it the stained glass ceiling and the stained glass cliff.
Yeah.
And that happens a lot because we're not looking for the right things. We're looking for, do we have a diverse slate of candidates, rather than, and this is how affirmative action was once explained to me, and I was like, oh, that makes so much more sense. Instead of just saying, we need X number, right, doing a quota system for affirmative action, it makes more sense to say, and this also would still be allowed and legal and gets around the recent Supreme Court decision, to say we're looking for particular experiences from people. So does this person have experience working cross-culturally? Does this person have experience engaging around differences, overcoming struggles or biases? And statistically, that is more likely to be a person of color or a marginalized person than it is to be a cis-het white person, because those of us who are white are so easily just surrounded by mostly white people. And Black, Indigenous people of color in this country frequently have to engage across cultural barriers because they are minorities. Gender and sexual minorities have to engage across cultural barriers because we are minorities. And so you get A, characteristics that are really good for any company or business, but also you are more likely to get candidates who don't just make it to the final slate, but also who are hired for the job. And those are particularly with, like, what are the characteristics you're looking for in a person? That helps to counter the implicit bias, because it is specific examples of things that are more likely to be the people who are discriminated against because of implicit bias. And there's some, like, blind hiring practices. I don't know what a more appropriate term is for that, but where, like, names will be taken off of resumes, so you don't see the name, so that you can't have the implicit bias of if the name sounds like a woman's name or sounds like a person of color. And that can help, but at some point, like, you're gonna actually meet the person and the implicit bias comes back, and it doesn't take into account the many, many times that person has already faced discrimination because of their name or their gender or whatever.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And one of the episodes that I think is a really interesting one that kind of deals with affirmative action is the West Wing episode from season 3, episode 12, which takes place during the Iowa caucuses for Bartlett's second term. And it's called The Two Bartletts. And affirmative action is just one part of the story, but CJ really, like, embodies the stereotypical white anti-affirmative action position, right? She is upset because her dad kept getting passed over for advancement opportunities because of her perception of a less qualified Black woman being hired.
Whereas I find it kind of difficult to believe that she actually, like, knew the qualifications of the people who her dad was going up against.
Yeah.
Personally,
but I think that every time I hear that from her, I'm like, CJ, come on. But I think it's important to recognize that that is the perspective. And part of what CJ doesn't say, but is implied in that, is her dad had some sort of entitlement to that position. He should have gotten that position, but it was taken from him, right? And she doesn't say it like that, but that's the mentality connected to that. And in the episode, there's also other stuff where Bartlett, like, fluffs on talking about it because he doesn't want to talk about it. He doesn't want to be clear about his beliefs. Charlie has a great perspective on it, obviously, because he is a Black man in the White House.
And generally brilliant.
And so, like, of course he's going to have a very accurate and thoughtful response to it. But it's a great episode because it gets at the assumptions of entitlement and competency that are underlying so much of the conversation that we have around affirmative action.
Sure.
So, all of that being said, why does this matter? Why does affirmative action matter? If you haven't already gotten the message, affirmative action, when done well, can help to counteract the ongoing harm of systemic injustices, the legacies of slavery, sexism, queerphobia, classism, Christian nationalism. All of those continue to impact us unless and until we can sufficiently counteract them. And so by counteracting that, or trying to counteract that, it creates a learning or other environment with more creative possibility and more engagement and more diverse experiences. It creates situations where the workforce, where the workers, where the students, where whoever it is that we're talking about has more opportunities to be creative and innovative. And it is not the be-all end all. It is a necessary component, and especially when it comes to, like, admissions and hiring practices, it is a precursor. It is the first step to a lot of the other work that still has to happen. The culture in schools and in companies still has to change and respond and grow. But it is unnecessary first step on a number of levels.
Yeah, unfortunately, it turns out there is no magic wand you can wave to undo all of the effects of bigotry in the world and the ongoing effects that it has in the policies and systems that already exist. Strange.
Yeah.
Also, on a more personal note regarding college admission specifically, school admission can't and should not be based solely on quantifiable things like test scores and GPAs if what you're going for is the best possible student body of students who are likely to graduate and add good reputation to your school.
Mm-hmm.
Well, okay, let me preface this by saying I'm talking about schools that are not for-profit institutions.
Right.
Don't go to for-profit institutions. They are out for money. They don't care about
yep.
you. Schools that aren't for-profit institutions, whether we're talking about state schools or private schools, ultimately speaking, what they're going for is a better reputation for themselves. And they get a good reputation from higher graduation rates, higher scores and grades in general, and higher accomplishments from their graduates. And therefore, these schools want their students to graduate. They want their students to get good grades and so on because they want this good reputation. So when the schools say that their students do better with a diverse student body, it's because they've seen it.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not saying that schools are acting purely out of altruism, because what they want is a better reputation, and this is how they would like to go about doing it. I am not saying that all college affirmative action policies regarding admissions are fair or reasonable or correct or even helpful, because I'm sure a lot of them aren't,
mm-hmm.
and they vary widely. But I think that the reason that they're trying is because they've seen it helps.
Mm-hmm.
Because otherwise they wouldn't bother. Also, continuing on that more personal note, do you want to get admitted to the school you want to go to, whether we are talking about undergraduate or graduate? Well, when it comes to undergraduate work, my first suggestion is get an associate's degree at a community college. You will save money,
mm-hmm.
you will prove to the four-year school that you want to go to that you can do the work and you are committed to finishing your degree. Four-year colleges love community college graduates because they can see that you are already doing the work and the effort of transferring shows that you are committed. Also, there are usually policies that if you get an actual associate's degree, rather than just doing 2 years in general at a community college and then transferring without the degree, usually if you have the degree, you will get better credit for the work that you did, and also more of your general education requirements will be out of the way. So you do want to go for a degree, rather than just going and taking some classes.
Mm-hmm.
Also, you want to have a plan for what degree, or at least what kind of degree, like what area are you going for what you want to get and why, and you want to focus on what you have accomplished and what you want to accomplish. Schools are looking for students who are focused on their studies and have a goal that they're working toward, because that's always a good sign in terms of how likely you are to graduate. Also, and this is really on a personal note because this was one of my mom's endless pet peeves, walking into a meeting with your academic advisor and saying that I want to be a doctor so I can be rich is not really the kind of goal I'm talking about. Like, I get it, but also, no, not exactly what we're talking about.
Yeah.
They hear that all
really?
The time. Yes, I want to be a doctor so I can be rich. Or, you know, sometimes it's I want to go into finance so I can be rich. I want to do so-and-so because I want to be rich. And then immediately afterwards, you find out that whatever the necessary skills are for that job or whatever, like, areas of education you need to focus on, those are the subjects that the student isn't good at. Like, students will walk in and say, I want to be a doctor so I can be rich. And they suck at biology and chemistry, or at least they did it in high school.
Fascinating.
That kind of thing.
It never would have occurred to me, even if I did want to do something to be rich, I never would have, like, told somebody that. I would have made up a different reason.
Oh, sure. Well, I mean, a lot of people go to college specifically because they're looking for financial stability, which makes sense to me. But also,
historically,
a lot of people coming...
currently.
Well, it varies, yeah. But also, a lot of people who come from a background where, say, they are the first generation of people to go to college in their family, because they don't get the coaching on how to talk to advisors, on how to talk to admissions people, that kind of thing, they wind up being less specific in what they're looking for. And they also don't necessarily know how to do research on what they're looking for.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, for example, if you want to go into the medical field, you figured that much out, I would suggest you do a little research, which you can do online for free, on what is required to go into various kinds of jobs. And remember that there are a lot of different kinds of jobs in the medical field.
Mm-hmm.
most people don't actually want to be doctors because it turns out that that's incredibly expensive and it takes a really long time, and often it kind of destroys your life in the process. Like, you will not sleep for 8 years. So this is maybe not actually, unless you really, really want specifically that and you are absolutely certain that is specifically what you want, look at some other choices. And so you might want to look into various kinds of physical therapy. There are technicians for labs or for various types of tests like x-rays, things like that. There are various kinds of nursing. There's a whole bunch of options. Look into stories from people who are in those various lines of work, which you again can find online, like on Reddit or social media or whatever. Talk to some people who are in those different kinds of lines of work and ask yourself questions like, okay, what are you good at? What do you like doing? What aren't you good at? What don't you like doing? If you are good with people, but you faint at the sight of blood, that's going to affect what kind of work you go into. If you are good at math, but you are bad at chemistry, it's going to affect which part of the field you go into, that kind of thing. And so knowing things like what you're good at and what you like and what you're bad at and what you don't like, that's half the battle.
And there are, especially in like the medical field, but I think in a lot of different areas, there are like things that your employer will do to help you. So for example, if you start out as a certified nursing assistant, that's the like first step is you become a certified nursing assistant. There are a lot of hospitals that will pay some or all of your educational expenses and tuition expenses to continue your degree or to get a degree in nursing.
Yes. Because our medical field is wildly understaffed at the moment and we need more people.
I think the same is probably the case in education, of if you come into education as a teacher's assistant or those sorts of things, then there's room
for some areas.
For some areas.
Yes. But basically, my point is you don't have to have an exact job description in mind when you're applying to your undergraduate college. That would be silly. But know some stuff about yourself and know some stuff about the general field that you want to go into. Mm-hmm. And that will help a lot, especially if you can verbalize those things. Yep. And also, just on a very practical note, plan for being the student that you are. Don't hinge your success in college at suddenly becoming a completely different person once you are a college student. If you are not a morning person, do not take 8 a.m. calculus. You will do yourself no favors. And also, people do that to themselves way more often than you'd think.
I believe that. Also, if you think you might have a learning disability, if you think you might be ADHD or dyslexic, check into that and figure that out, because you are entitled to accommodations. I think it's every college that accepts federal funding, which is basically every college.
Yeah. But especially the ones who are not for profit, because you don't want to go to the for-profit
places. We're not going to those anyway. Have learning centers that can help you. They have stuff to specifically give you the accommodations that you need in order to succeed in classes.
Yes. So if you're ever going to get tested, you want to do it in college, because they can probably help you with that.
Or before.
That said, I'm not entirely sure how, like, Florida has recently completely destroyed the DEI offices of their educational system. And so I'm not sure if they still have those offices.
I think destroying the DEI offices, that's not going to be the same as medical the learning centers stuff. And stuff to specifically support students with disabilities. So definitely take advantage of that. Again, with affirmative action, it's not that you are trying to take advantage or get something that other people haven't. They are there to help mitigate.
Equalize your experience.
Yeah. Make it so that you're on the same playing field rather than being at a disadvantage.
And we're not saying that you have to get all of this figured out before you start the college admissions process. We're saying that once you're at college, you can get a lot of help there.
Yes.
Like, if you can figure it out beforehand, hey, that's great, but not everybody has those resources.
But definitely, it's worth it to figure that out, because otherwise, it's so hard.
Yeah.
Also, when it comes to things like equity, equality, justice, diversity, there's a lot of learning that we all still have to do. And there are two resources that I will specifically encourage you to check out, and we'll link to them in our episode description. But there's a daily or weekly e-newsletter thing called Anti-Racism Daily that I have subscribed to. And if you do the weekly one, you get a recap of all of the articles sent during the week, so you can click on them and the ones that you're interested in. But it does a really good job of looking at intersectional concerns around not just explicitly racist things, but they've also done a lot around the anti-trans bills and a variety of different categories. So it gets into the specifics, and the weekend edition has like people can write in with questions and they'll answer them. So it's a fantastic thing. They also have started doing diversity, equity, inclusion trainings. So if you are interested in that for your organization, I don't have any experience with them doing it, but I do have experience with the newsletter and it's fantastic. So I would check them out. Also, anti-racism training in general is so important. It's best if you can get a group to go to it. So a group from your workplace or your school or something, or get it hosted by your workplace or your school. But even like the times that I've done it and I've been kind of thinking about something that there's no one else in the group who's like connected to that specific thing, it's been really helpful in my own understanding and analysis of organizational structures and those sorts of things. And the one I've done the most is Crossroads Anti-Racism Training, which is based out of Chicago, but there are a whole bunch of different people, different groups do them online or in person, all sorts of opportunities and options. And that education helps us with our own implicit bias, but also helps us look at the structures that need to change to take into account implicit bias and structural harm and historical harm.
Yeah.
And our readings. So as we dive into our readings, our first reading is from Isaiah chapter 56, verse 1 and verses 6 through 8. God proclaims that all people who serve God are equally God's own, no matter where they are from or what their body or gender is like. So one of the things that happens in this passage is the Revised Common Lectionary creators have cut out verses 2 through 5, which is the place where like a lot of people maybe feel discomfort. But that's also the blessing of eunuchs. So don't do that. Don't exclude things that make you uncomfortable. I love verses 2 through 5, so I'm really excited that Kay took one of those verses. But also this reminded me of, I've been watching and learning a lot about a supposed artificial intelligence, but really just like algorithms. And that like the things we call AI learn what something is, how to do something, by excluding outliers. So there was a thing of like looking up photorealistic picture, like having AI come up with photorealistic images of autistic people, of an autistic person, and 100% of the time the person was white. 95% of the time, I think, the person was a boy. 90% of the time it was a child, like a child, not just a boy slash man.
Sure.
So there's actually like a lot of evidence that is now like coming out as we're studying things that AI actually amplifies bias instead of pushing against it or not having a bias. And I think about that for this passage from Isaiah, that like when we leave out the things that make us uncomfortable, that maybe are outliers, we miss out, right? This reading would be so much richer if it included the eunuch's blessing. So if you are the preacher for the day, please consider including this particular passage in its full in your reading, or at least talking about it in your preaching. And we've done an episode on eunuchs and gender, and we'll link to that in the episode description. But
yeah,
it's a blessing that people need to hear, and there's so much that connects queer people to eunuchs, for better and for worse. They're not the only example of queer people in the Bible, but that blessing is powerful. Don't keep it locked up.
Yeah, absolutely. Although I don't know that I'm addressing verse 2 in the way that you were exactly
hoping for. No, but you're like addressing verse 2 and acknowledging that it exists.
Sure. So in verse 2, we read, "Happy is the mortal who does this, the one who holds it fast, the one who keeps the Sabbath, not profaning it, and refrains from doing any evil." So notice that this verse doesn't say that you have to be a kind or helpful or perfect person. Like, this is literally just about following God's law and not actually being evil. That is a fairly reasonable bar to set. Like, you can still be petty or mean, I guess, under these rules. And it reminds me of, in the book The Goblin Emperor, the character Setharis is one of the people we meet first. And yes, of course, he's racist, and his concept of childcare is pretty horrible. But also, like, it turns out, he's not a murderer, and he refuses to commit actual treason. He has standards. They're just, you know, kind of low and pretty weird, but there are standards there. So we're not saying that you have to be perfect, by any means. And then in verse 6, we read, "And the foreigners who join themselves to the Lord, to minister to him and love the name of the Lord, and to be his servants, all who keep the Sabbath and do not profane it and hold fast my covenant." Well, speaking of keeping the Sabbath, let's remember that that was not just about taking a day off yourself in the ancient world, but it was also about making sure that everyone in your household, no matter how low status they were, also got a day of rest. And that included rest from doing tasks to care for themselves, like their own laundry or cleaning. And so you had to allow them time to do that during other times of the week. And so this is a justice issue. And so the thing that occurs to me while I was thinking about this was I kept hearing Will Smith during the movie Independence Day yelling, "I could have been at a barbecue!" Because, you know, your time off actually is important, even if you're being attacked by aliens.
That is a great argument for a four-day work week.
Sure.
It is. Look up 4-day work weeks. They're fantastic.
Yes, that's like a couple of steps past where I was going.
I mean, yes, but we don't have somebody, like, we got to have time to do the things. We got to have time to rest. Just so many things.
Absolutely.
And then in the second half of verse 7, God is talking about gathering people to God's holy mountain and says, "Their burnt offerings and their sacrifices will be accepted on my altar, for my house shall be called a house of prayer for all people." And last night I watched the Jesus Revolution movie, which I didn't realize it was like based on the like birthing of what is like now the modern evangelical movement, but I thought it was going to be a comedy. I was wrong. It seems a little bit like propaganda for the evangelical movement, but one of the things that was really cool about it is the ways it depicted the revitalization of congregations that were at the point of like very few people were coming, all of that stuff, into a house of prayer for all peoples, particularly including hippies. And there's just this beautiful, like, blossoming group of hippies that start coming to worship, and it's a really great image for this.
Sure.
And then in verse 8, we read, "Thus says the everlasting God who gathers the outcasts of Israel, I will gather others to them besides those already gathered." And this reminded me of Star Wars Rebels, which I am currently watching for another podcast that is currently paused because of the writer's strike and the SAG-AFTRA strike. So yay, unions and striking workers, support them. Yay, labor. But in the recent episode in season 3, Senator Mon Mothma resigns, has finally like hit the point where like she's like, this is not working. I can't do anything more in the Senate because it's just too corrupt. And so she resigns from the Senate and issues this call to people to join the rebellion, which at this point has just been a bunch of scattered cells, and they all go to the place to meet up. And then all of these different ships start to show up. And it's just this beautiful, like, gathering all those who want justice, who want a democratic and representative intergalactic government together, together. And it's beautiful.
Our second reading for this episode is from Romans chapter 11, verses 1 through 2a and 29 through 32. Paul explains in his letter to the Romans that God has not rejected anyone, but will show mercy to all.
So a theme common for the last couple of weeks of Romans is God remains with the Jewish people. We're going to say this pretty much every time it comes up because anti-Semitism is bad. God is still with the Jewish people. That covenant has not been broken. Christians don't replace it. Thus, Jewish people and God still super tight. Kind of like the way vibranium remains with the people of Wakanda, even as they share the technology and their own advancements. But throughout, like from Black Panther, even into the second Black Panther movie, Wakanda remains the people with the vibranium. Jewish people remain the people with God. Not that God is vibranium, but you know what I mean, right?
Yeah. I get where you're going. I might have gone with the heart flower.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's what I mean. The heart flower remains with the people of Wakanda.
Thanks. Okay, so as we jump into the verses, in verse 1, we read, "I ask then, has God rejected his people? By no means. I myself am an Israelite, a descendant of Abraham, a member of the tribe of Benjamin." Paul, buddy, this is not making the argument that you think it's making. Like, you are literally the most prolific author of the early church, and you admit that your separation from your heritage is something that you grieve. And so, once again, we are forced to ask, how would the history of the church be different if Paul had been able to get some therapy? There is literally a meme for this. Men will literally travel continents and write thousands of words to churches all over instead of going to therapy. Not that therapy was technically, you know, an option back then, but... Paul, you have some issues with your identity and your social connections, and you should really try to sort some of those out. Wow. And then in verse 2a, we read, God has not rejected God's people whom God foreknew. The ethics of being able to see the future are, you know, complicated, especially mm-hmm. since we rarely get to talk to anyone who can mm-hmm. do it, or at least talk in a way that we get to hear back about how that goes. But presumably, creating a group of people, knowing in advance what they're going to do, and then rejecting them later would be cruel and unusual. And so I wonder if this means, does this work as an argument for universal salvation since God created everyone?
I mean, I vote yes, but...
I could see it.
Also, I'm particular about being pretty much a universalist, so, you know.
Yeah. I will also just straight up admit that I went for these two verses instead of the verses later on, because I was doing this before I had my coffee, and I could not entirely figure out what those later verses, you know, meant. I was not able to get there from here. So
that's fantastic. Well,
I looked at verse 30 and 31 and just said, you know what, no.
I mean, I also skipped verses 30 and 31, but I did mine last night before bed. So, yeah. Mm-hmm. In verse 29, we read, "For the gifts and the calling of God are irrevocable." And I love that particular thing. And one of my friends who's a Jewish rabbi talked about, at one point, we were talking about conversion to Judaism, and the tradition is that you have to like ask three times to become Jewish. And he talked about discouraging conversion to Judaism because it is committing forever to a covenant and to expectations. So like there is a conversion in a religious sense and in a faith sense to like become part of a community. But also like once you are Jewish forever, even if you convert to another religion, because Judaism is not just a religion, but also an ethnicity. There is a different sense of what it means to convert to Judaism and to then be Jewish. And so this, like, the gifts and calling of God are irrevocable. That, like, once you say, okay, God, I'm here for this covenant, then that's, like, you're here for the covenant. You're held to those standards, which I kind of really like. Like, I like that there is that way of understanding and experiencing relationship with God of like whether or not you even believe in God or are atheist or become atheist or like all of those things.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then in verse 32 we read, "For God has imprisoned all in disobedience so that God may be merciful to all." That's, you know, one description of free will, kind of. But it sounds more like the Capitol's perspective in the Hunger Games of like, the reason they do the Hunger Games is as a gift to the districts and to everyone to remind them of the pain of war. And it's like, the Hunger Games are not a gift. Forcing the districts to sacrifice 2 kids every year is not a gift, no. So, you know, thanks, Paul, but I feel like we're both like, Paul, the things you're saying are maybe not... are not getting the message across that you want to get across.
Yeah.
Today.
This seems to be a continuing message. Yeah. Hmm.
And then we dive into our gospel reading, which is Matthew chapter 15, verses 10 through 20 are optional, and then verses 21 through 28. After pointing out that defilement comes from the heart, not food that is eaten, Jesus is confronted by a Canaanite woman, calls her a dog, and then, impressed by her faith, expands his mission from only the people of Israel to all people. So one of the themes in this passage is the idea of like a turn of phrase. And I know that Matthew says it's about the woman's faith, but Mark, the earlier version, says it's about her words. And right now, I am just in this space where I really want an epic rap battle between Jesus and the Canaanite woman, because the Canaanite woman would win the epic rap battle. I'm just saying.
when you say epic rap battle, I don't go to, like, actual rap battles in my head. What I immediately start picturing is that TV show where celebrities will cover a song and they compete against each other for who can do the best cover, and thus we have that wonderful gif of Dwayne The Rock Johnson singing Shake It Off, and also Tom Holland's version of Umbrella, and so forth.
Umbrella is the one that I have seen the most of.
Oh, yes, absolutely. So now I'm getting a mental image of, you know, Jesus singing Shake It Off in my head, and, you know, actually, it's kind of fun.
That's fantastic. No, I was thinking of...
I realize that's not
what you're... while ago, there was a YouTube trend of epic rap battles with historical figures.
Oh, I did not see that. Okay.
That's what I was thinking of, where they, like, had, I don't know, like, Luther and Calvin or something, and it was hilarious. They did a bunch of them, but I think an epic rap battle between Jesus and the Canaanite woman would be phenomenal.
Absolutely, yes.
And then in verse 14, we read Jesus saying, "Let them alone. They are blind guides of the blind. And if one blind person guides another, both will fall into a pit." And I just need to say, that is not how that works. Like, yes, blind skiers benefit from having guides who can see. But in general, blind people are a lot of the time actually the best guides for other blind people, especially for people who are newly blind, so not like blind from birth, because they have figured out how to navigate the world without visual sight, and so can better guide other people in navigating the world and give them tips and tricks and stuff. And if the power ever goes out, blind people are probably the best guides at night because they don't need light to navigate.
Yeah. So as we read verse 21, we read, "Jesus left that place and went away into the district of Tyre and Sidon." And yes, actually, I'm pretty sure it's pronounced Tyre. That's okay. And the subtext here is that Jesus is leaving the place that is Israel, where he, as a Jewish man, is in the majority. Most people around him are of his culture and faith and background. And he is going into a place where he is the minority. Most people around him are not of his culture and faith and background. And so this meeting that he's about to have with the Canaanite woman has some guess who's coming to dinner vibes to it. This is a classic movie that was famously one of the first to show interracial relationships in a positive light, with Sidney Poitier as the prospective son-in-law having dinner with Katharine Hepburn and Spencer Tracy, and also the actress who played his fiancée, Catherine Houghton, I think was her name. She was not nearly as famous as any of the rest of them. Mm-hmm. And as a doctor and a rich man, Sidney Poitier's character has a lot in common with his educated and well-off hosts, but as a black man planning to marry into a white family in a movie that came out literally 6 months after the Loving Supreme Court decision that made interracial relationships legal across the country, he is not in the majority at all. That is an incredibly awkward meal. It is, however, a great movie. And I thought that really the whole movie was handled very well, although I haven't seen it for several years now. The one part that I genuinely had trouble watching was that later on in the movie, you do have a scene that portrays Spencer Tracy's character beginning the process of cognitive decline. And that was just hard to watch as someone who has gone through Alzheimer's repeatedly in my family. So I'll give you that warning. But the meal part itself is just absolutely excellent, and all of the actors are in their prime. It's amazing.
Nice. I have not seen it, but it sounds cool.
Yeah.
And then in verse 22, we read, "Just then, a Canaanite woman from that region came out and started shouting, 'Have mercy on me, Lord, Son of David. My daughter is tormented by a demon.'" And the use of the term Canaanite here is a bit like the use of mankind. Canaanite was not a term used at that time. Syrophoenician is the term used in Mark, and that's the kind of the term that was more common in that time. But it is intended to evoke a thing. It is intended, in this case, Canaanite, is intended to evoke the memory of the Canaanite people who were wiped out, or at least attempted to be wiped out, by the Israelites when they entered the Promised Land. So, like, there's a thing that's meant to be evoked, but that's not actually, like, the term that we use or could or should use today. Kind of like mankind evokes a thing, but you can use things like humankind or humanity to actually like encompass everybody, and you don't need to keep using that archaic word just to sound fancy and sci-fi.
Yeah.
I have opinions.
And then in verse 24, we read, Jesus answered, I was sent only to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. And I realize that I have said that other Bible verses make me think of this too in the past on this podcast, but this is yet another one of those examples where I hear Han Solo in the back of my head yelling, it's not my fault! Like, you can still do something about this, Han. That is, in fact, the point of this entire story.
Exactly. Also, if you want more about this passage, we will link to our episode on biblical cussing, because in fact, when Jesus calls this woman a dog, it's cussing. It means what you think it means.
Yeah.
And we recorded that episode in for the Mark version of this story. So I think that'll also be a helpful thing for anybody who's like looking at comparing them, but just in general about biblical cussing and how it comes up and that sort of thing. Check it out.
Yeah. And now for our
diverse
most affirmative segment.
Okay. I was going for most diverse, like maybe
I mean,
I don't know,
sometimes
affirming.
We do occasionally cast humans, so that probably counts.
Yeah. I mean, also the Muppets are very diverse.
Yes. Let's make a Muppets musical. Emily, who would you like to cast?
Absolutely, 100% Miss Piggy is the Canaanite woman who will definitely take on Jesus and his denial of care for her child.
See, I love that. And also, my other reaction to that would be, I also want another person in that scene, not as Jesus, but in having a reaction to the scene, because Rolf totally has to be there and then stare straight into the camera after Jesus calls her a dog, because Rolf is a dog. And also, as if that weren't enough, none of the Muppets are white because none of them are, you know, human beings, but Rolf is sort of coded to be African-American, or have some cultural traits in common with the African-American community. And so the idea of not only is he a dog, but also he has a relationship with a racial minority community. Yeah, his reaction to that scene would be pretty fantastic. Maybe he's the one, you know, playing the musical background on his piano to the scene. And then Jesus says that and the music just stops suddenly, or like he clinks a weird chord and then stares straight into the camera. And then the scene continues horribly awkwardly.
I think that's a great idea. And like, I mean, he could also be a disciple, right? Because Jesus is going with his disciples, but
he's the disciple who's carrying the piano around. Well, the other disciples are carrying the piano and he's the one playing the piano because, you know, Jesus always needs a musical backdrop.
Obviously.
If this is the Muppets musical. Yeah.
It's true. Okay. But then who is Jesus? Like, is that the token
that's a good
human?
Question. Possibly.
I know we generally don't cast Jesus as human, but also,
well, in this case, I think I would want Jesus to be a Palestinian too, because like there are some added layers on this once you realize that these days Jesus is a minority in the larger world.
Yeah. And there's also like,
and he was then too,
an economic clash, because this woman probably had more money than Jesus, because Jesus like wanders around homeless,
itinerant,
there we go. But, and she probably like was from an upper class, and it's just like such a big trauma collision. But yeah, I don't know who I would cast though for Jesus.
Yeah. And also like keep in mind that he's got to be in his early 30s, so he can't be too old
either.
And like a lot of the actors
that we cast are like
that
older
I would
ones.
Think of immediately are way too old. Like, because I was immediately thinking of Rami Malek, or I can never remember his last name, the actor who played Julian Bashir in Deep Space Nine. But
I guess we'll have to leave it up to our listeners to tell us who they would cast.
Who would you cast as Jesus?
Yeah, let us know. Thanks for joining us. Catch us next time when we'll discuss nerdery connections to the scripture readings for the 13th Sunday after Pentecost with our special guest, Bishop Brenda Boss.
Yay.
This podcast has been produced by us, Emily Ewing and Kay Roloff. For more fun, check us out on Twitter and Facebook at Nerds at Church, or contact us at nerdsatchurch@gmail.com.
Also, if you like what you've heard, rate us or leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Facebook, or wherever you catch your podcasts. If you want access to our uncut guest episodes and interviews, live Q&As, and more, support us on Patreon at patreon.com/nerdsatchurch. It's cheaper than taking expensive tests like the SAT or ACT and then applying to colleges.
Indeed it is. Also, let us know on Facebook or Twitter who you would cast for Let's Make a Muppets Musical for this episode.
As the ancient Christians said,
Pax vobiscum.